So hello everyone, thank you for coming, so many of you. My name is Massimiliano Gioni. I'm moderating the panel this morning. The panel, as you can see, is titled The Museum, Institutions of Market or Measure. In fact, we will discuss many other things and many other aspects. There is an irony to this panel because basically nobody on this panel actually works in a traditional museum. I don't know if it was a perverse choice of Neville Wakefield to bring us together or if he hoped that we would present new, fresh perspective. But I'll introduce the guest, first of all, and then say a couple of words about the general topic, and then let each guest present their own very individual perspective. To my left is Julia Payton-Jones, the director of the Serpentine Gallery. Further down is Lisa Dennison, who recently just left the Guggenheim Museum, where she was the director, to join Sotheby's and become the executive vice president of Sotheby's. I'm sure that this will generate many questions and discussions also today as we comment the relationship, the twisted and sometimes perverse relationship between private sector, market, and museums and institutions. And further down, Elaine Sturtevant, who is an artist. I also like to call her a legend because she's much more than an artist, and whose work I hope you're all familiar with, that can be easily described and defined as a probably one of the most stubborn research about repetition, originality, and authorship. She's known for appropriating and replicating other artists' work besides her own work, and I think her presence here also questions what the boundaries of museums are. As always, when I am given the uncomfortable role of being a moderator, I like to start off very simply by looking to the etymology of the word that you have to discuss. In this case, museum, as I'm sure you're all familiar with, museum simply comes from the word muses. And muses, if you go back and study a little mythology or simply just Google it or check out on Wikipedia, the muses were the daughters of two quite extraordinary gods and goddesses. One is Zeus, so the god of creation, and the other one is Memnonise, the god of memory. So since its very beginning, since its very linguistic origin, the museum is split between being a site for creation, a site for freedom, a site for advancement and questioning of boundaries, and on the other hand, it's a site for the preservation of memory. Traditionally, in the 20th century, I would say that, or at least for the first half of the 20th century, memory became the leading aspect of museum practice, and then little by little, things kind of got mixed up, and actually Julia is here, and her Serpentine Gallery is probably one of the most extreme examples nowadays of a museum that doesn't engage with memory, but engages with creating the future or creating a sort of factory for the future. I think this is probably the most important, two elements to keep in mind in this discussion, to which I hope you will also participate. And another very crucial element and another paradox is that this discussion happens in an art fair, which, again, it's maybe another perversity of our contemporary art system, that the reflection about curating and the reflection about museum often happens within the territory of the art fair. So we are here to discuss the market and to discuss the limits of museums, and we are invited to do so in the very territory that feeds the museum and the very territory where museum feed off from. So I think also in the course of the discussion we'll touch upon how challenging and difficult it is to imagine memory and to imagine the future in a place that is so much connected with market and money and economy and competition. I think these are just some of the topics that I wanted to throw out there and that we will return to in form of discussion and also with your participation. I'll pass it on to Lisa Dennison, that just because of her recent, not just because of that, but because of her recent change in her career, I think she has an incredibly valuable perspective on both the market and museums, and I'm sure she can give us a few insights on the thin borders and sometimes the promiscuity of these borders. So welcome, Lisa Dennison, and I'll pass on the word to her.
Thank you.
I'm happy to talk about promiscuity. So as Massimiliano said, I'm here sort of wearing two hats, because for over 30 years I was involved with the Guggenheim Museum in a curatorial capacity, and most recently as its director for 2 years. And then I rocked the art world. I think it's safe to say that, because that's what everybody tells me, shock and awe, by abandoning my most prestigious post as the director of an institution I adore to join a public company, an auction house. So I'm going to speak principally wearing my museum hat, because I think when I was invited to this panel, I think I was still director at the museum, but my perspective is unique, and I am holding my Sotheby's catalog only because I need something to take notes on. But if anybody has any questions, I'm on the tonight is our contemporary art sale. I'm very excited, so I'm thinking very much about the market today and hoping the market remains strong and robust. But I came to the art fair, and always come to art fairs as a museum director or curator, and indeed it's true that as you look around, as I walk through the fair, I see my colleagues from that world here, and it is a unique sort of force of nature that art fairs are magnets for museums to come to a city en masse with their patrons, their trustees, to even buy. And certainly one of the things that irks the Guggenheim so much, is that the Tate has this fund to buy from art fairs, and they're given privileged access before we even get through the door. And as you all know, the first through the gate snaps up the great lots, and after that, catch as catch can. But it's, interesting to me to think about museums in the market, because I always did. And there was an article in the art newspaper this summer by Jane Collier who said that the art world is supported by four pillars: artists, collectors, dealers, and the art historical establishment. And at various points in history, the power or the weight has shifted from one to the other. Now, it is really clear today that museums do not hold the power, and that they are chasing rather than guiding the market. And one of the things my principal activity as a museum director and curator, what gave me the most passion and pleasure was collection building. It was great to curate exhibitions, but I felt that the legacy of the museum is in its holdings, the statement it made by what it chose to collect, and just creating that legacy was really important to me. And I never felt that museums should be in the process of looking at trends or creating trends or discovery. We were not in the discovery business, because the lasting value of art accrues in the course of generations. So what we needed to do was reflect and think and make choices that would sustain themselves throughout all time, and that is not easy to do. And so why go to art fairs, why go to auction houses and, take the temper of the art market? It was a question I often asked myself, because museums simply can't compete in a market like today. Because an art fair and the art market and the auction houses are all about speed. It's about the ability to react. And the world has gotten speedier with the growth of certainly the globalization of art and information and sharing information via the internet, and the growth of the markets, the broader wealth, the great liquidity that exists in the world today in many different markets, not just Europe or America, has made it really impossible for museums to react with speed, because we have filters, and you notice I keep saying we. We have filters and layers of approval processes versus the collector who can go in there and make these choices. So on one level, it's a depressing kind of phenomenon, but on another level, it's not. Because I believe that two things, that number one, all of the collectors in the world are doing their jobs and building collections with vision, maybe idiosyncratic, but ultimately my hope and belief is they'll be absorbed back into the museum system, because you will all go on to die or pass your legacy on to your children or your children's children who may not want it, who may gift it to a museum or may bring it into the auction world so that it's now back in the public domain and museums can react. And over time, the collectors will do their job and the museums will sit back and watch and will do their job about carefully choosing what comes into their collection. But museums are they collect collections. And I think that today's museums need to think about new models of collecting, because you cannot buy modern masterpieces. Who can buy Rothko's at $75 million? I remember my very first show at the Guggenheim that I was involved with on day one in October of 1978 was a Rothko retrospective. I don't think the whole show was valued at $75 million in those days. So how do museums collect? And I think new models is really the thing to think about and what I spent a lot of time thinking about. And I think one of the things that can be done more effectively is collection sharing. All museums and institutions have much more than they can possibly show at any given period of time. And I don't see why museums can't partner with collectors or partner with other museums. I was trying to promote instances where the Guggenheim and the Tate would go in together and buy something hugely ambitious, store it somewhere and share it. And I think that immediately cuts the price in half. We were involved in a transaction with three museums in the United States, one in San Francisco, one in Houston, and one in New York, to share something that could be fabricated and refabricated on each site. I think that museums, and so I really think that's a huge future for museums. I think museums shouldn't duplicate. I don't think if the Museum of Modern Art and the Whitney Museum and the Guggenheim are all in one city with limited real estate to show their collections, that we should all be buying the same things. I think you need to focus on identity. I think that it's important to partner with collectors, but to get into a partnership at the beginning that says, you may enjoy part ownership of this work in your lifetime, but you're going to make the commitment now to get that work into a museum so that so there's no wiggle room. And that's been made more challenging, certainly, by a change in tax laws in America, which takes away a deduction for fractional interest gifts, and by the fact that in most European cities there are no tax incentives. I think museums have to look at sort of undervalued gaps, places where you just look at an artist and you say, my God, he or she is in the history books forever. It may not be the trend of the moment, but now is the time to make a serious move because everybody else is chasing this trend. So you have to be very, very savvy about that and really eschew trends. And lastly, I think I would say that one of the models that we used effectively at the Guggenheim was to a couple of things. Commission artists. I think that's just a great, great way to give an artist an opportunity to create something for an institution on a scale that may be unimaginable, to guarantee that artist that it will be in the collection for a lifetime, and to be able to purchase at an undervalued, in an undervalued market or price. And they do that very effectively in our museum in Berlin, which is supported by Deutsche Bank. I think another model is to expand the parameters of the collection, and one of the things we started was an Asian art initiative, but the mandate to the curators was don't go to the art fairs and to the galleries. There, I think there's an opportunity to really get your ear to the ground in an emerging market and understand what's at the core of it and maybe make some choices early on before these works come into an international art market. And another thing that we instituted, which I really love, is we got a collector to give us a discretionary curatorial fund that someone is funding, and that we have convinced our board this isn't a ton of money. Forget the layers and approval process and let the curators walk around and make some choices with immediacy, things that they feel strongly about, and let the board trust us. So that may help balance the other side of the collection by allowing curators, again, not to be discovering trends, but to respond to things that they feel very, very excited about. A collection has to have a strategy, and the best strategy in the world, where you analyze your weaknesses, you analyze your strengths, you identify gaps, you identify acquisition priorities, can totally be overturned by opportunity. And the biggest issue, I think, for museums today is how to respond to these opportunities, and that's where new models come in. So I've thrown out a bunch of ideas. I'll leave it back to you, and I'm happy to explore them all in some depth as we continue.
Thank you so much. I'll maybe just react by asking you a question before we pass on the word to Elaine. you insisted a lot about speed, which seems to be one of the most relevant elements of today's market. You know, everybody's talking about how nice it was that the fair was open for a few hours to a very, very limited group, and how that took away the craziness of Basel, in which you have lots of people and everybody trying to buy in the first 2 hours. First of all, I want to ask you, as a former museum director, if you had lost major works and occasions because the museum was too slow. And the second question is, it's a different question about the temporality of art. So not the speed of the market, but, you know, we walk around, I don't know how many thousands of objects are in this fair, but my question is, how long are they gonna last, the vast majority of it? And do we really need this much art? Which actually will lead us also to Elaine, because I always think that her work has something of an ecology of thought, because it's not about putting in new objects again, but it's also about replicating and repeating objects. So it's I always admire her work for being somehow ecological. It's about preserving and it's about repeating memory and not polluting with new visions. But anyway.
Well, I'm going to leave the temporality issue to Elaine, because I think she raised that point in our pre-discussion and has a lot to say about it. But yes, of course we lose things because of speed. I mean, 2 extra hours before the hordes of people come in does not guarantee that museums can react any better. And I remember last year we did, our curator and I went to a booth and saw Zwerner and saw Francis Alise, and we just loved it. And we said, I think we can get behind this. I think we have the funds. I think we can convince our board. Let's put it on reserve. That's anathema to the dealers, because reserves mean anything can happen. They'd rather know they have the sale. Well, it just so happens the Tate had already put a reserve on it because they got the pre-access, so we were very annoyed. But speed is an issue. But, you know, museums should not, you know, speed should not really be a criteria. You have to really have a thoughtful concept and belief in what you're trying to build. And I think we are better off saying to a dealer, we're interested in Francis Alise, for example, let's think about a program by which we'll bring that work into the collection. It doesn't have to be today. It doesn't even have to be this year. But let's make sure we get the right piece for the museum. What the art fair does is it allows you to walk around, and as you sort out this morass of thousands of too much art, as you say, things start to rise to the top. And I think what it does is it allows you to help make discerning choices and to think about who does look relevant, whose voice can be heard amidst these thousands of artists. And that should lead you back to a discussion with the artist or with the dealer representing the artist to say, let's find something that's really worthy of a museum collection if we are going to take on the responsibility of maintaining it, of preserving it in perpetuity. Its preservation, its scholarship, its presentation. Those are big responsibilities. And before we make those choices, often with public money, we should be very, very sure that we're making the right choices, which, of course, you can never be sure of.
So thank you so much. And so Elaine Sturtevant, I don't know if she needs further introductions. I think she can just take the floor and...
Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read. I didn't realize we were supposed to just sort of talk. So it's brief, but I am going to be reading it. And the focus is predominantly on what is available to museums to put into their exhibitions. Considering the parameters, it's not very good, is it? Considering the parameters, thank you. That's good, thanks. Parameters, limitation, and impositions that underlie the structure of museums, it is a bit of a miracle that they are still around. And more impressive is that they manage, can we do something about that mic? Where's our man? Where's our head man here? And more impressive is that they managed to find a director willing to take on the heavy burden. The total structure is fraught with inherent dangers and imperatives. The big mind bender is money. It seems to be okay now.
Yeah, but it's not really amplified.
So it's on.
That's why it's okay.
Oops.
Are we okay? Okay. The big mind bender is money. Money found, money given, with not so concealed invested interests, money with moral and ethical issues, like encounters of the worst kind, money aggravated by escalating cost of everything and anything, with the new irritant of collectors demanding fees for loans, a soft murmur of a shift from commitment to museums to the harsh noise of art as money. And what about the staggering imperatives? Blockbusters, top of the notch attendance, bowing to the demands for entertainment, but this is popular culture, and so. This brings us to the harsh reality of what there is to be shown, the choices available for exhibitions in museums of contemporary art. Eliminating the trend of showing objects of use, as in motorcycles, which I think is wonderful. I can get to the next page here. And other new slots of art, in order for art not to divest itself. What is the current art of artists in the narrow parameters of sculpture, painting, and video? Despite all its diversity, the running thread of current art is reflection and demonstration of cybernetic straight stranglehold on all that we see and do. Our obsession with the exterior, our thrust to surface, has left man without an interior. Stuck with image over image, and he is his own self-referential self. Just as object in itself is now its own representation. I lost my voice the other day for 5 days, so I hope this doesn't happen. This is art under a very tight digital hold. The predominance of subjective art that is without transcendence, if that word is still around, looking at soiled beds would appear to give us an identity, to place ourselves elsewhere, not voyeurism, but a way to fill the interior. Teeny bopper art, with its fake garden rooms and portraits of romantic innocent girls, all indicate a move backwards, a regression that gives false protection, a safe fairy tale. Or huge museum rooms filled with huge inflated balloons floating all about with super slicky painted eyes and smiles, a throw from Japanese comics. Beautiful and fun, but an agonizing jump to denial of what is here and now. The mad rush for information, which of course is emphatically not knowledge, is found in videos that present three channels impeccably filmed medical procedures or tells us about the not so frozen ice caps. Political art is everywhere, reflecting our razor edge madness to hate, to kill, to die, our desire for death. Extremely difficult to make political art. Redoing the Med Hut that was once the Saddam Hussein's hideout removes the viewer from the frisson of violence. Looking at an object of war wandering around such an installation is entertainment, not political art. Political art engenders polemics, galvanizes action, and triggers thought. Then there's the art in which production is its means, consumption its purpose, and use its meaning. Art is now to use. Narrative videos of lateral experience, which with cyber interference is not experience, and often with blatant noise that has no relationship to the content and only there to distract from man's vast, barren interior. all this mishmash functions within the framework of distance from self and place as being. It is no imperative to strongly state that this is not trashing current art, and to reiterate that this art is directly the result of cybernetics' destructive power, just as it has rendered man disposable and dispensable, and so on and so on. And this is not a very interesting grab bag for museums to create an exhibition, but it does enthrall the masses. It does push and shove towards the lowest common denominator. And this is what we seem to be striving for. Critics and curators seem gung-ho for this razzmatazz, but why not? There's nothing else around. What can museums do when art has become doing rather than being? When art is to use and to consume? When everyone desires and thinks they are an artist? When creativity is no longer hanging out? When our digital immersion has made originality a myth? Nothing. They can do nothing. They are compelled to bring culture to the people, and they do that, unable to change the force and power of cybernetics intrusion. Later, much later, what the doings of art will be is a wild thing to contemplate. Of course, there is always the possibility that current mode of listening in place of seeing, earphones plugged into the ears while listening to a painting, could be reversed to listening, to touch the edge of understanding, to know that art can be not great art and yet be great art, because it has guts and passion. Guts and passion and balls to show, to shout, to tell us how we are, how we must fight, resist, and rebel. Perhaps museums could be the sites of revolution. Hey, that's a great idea. Let's do that.
So, thank you so much. I would react with two quick questions to you two, because first of all, it's clear that as an artist, the relationship with museums is always one of love and hate.
Oh, the few museum shows I've had, super.
Yeah.
Absolutely super.
But there is something about the idea of institution of museum that even you address in the first paragraph that makes the it's a generalization, but makes the artist a little uncomfortable. You know, the famous Ed Ruscha title for his first retrospective was "I don't want no retrospective," which I think has always been a very interesting.
No, not really, Max. I'm sorry. Firstly, no one wants a retrospective, because once you have a retrospective, it's the end of you.
Yeah.
So forget that. But I'm not. I don't go into that bag at museums. Blah 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 blah. No, I think that, like I started out, I think it's incredible what they do, considering what the parameters are today. It's very impressive. And I'd like to state again, every museum show I've had has just been like Uta Kittelman at the MMK. I mean, this was a real, real big time high, okay? So, and many other museums. So, well, not many. I haven't had that many museum shows. But anyway, yes, I'm very much for museums. And I think you did mention at some point the museum's responsibility to artists. I think it should be artists' responsibility to the museums. Huh?
Great.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. No, this is, nobody thinks that's a possibility, but we could think about it.
Another issue that I think it's coming out of your text and probably is very much connected to the practice of both Julie and Lisa is the issue of entertainment, which has changed things around for museums, has changed things around for fairs. I mean, even the setting of this talk is modeled after the talk show on TV, which I find completely absurd. And for some reason, in art fairs, there is always a lounge. There is always this idea that, you know, knowledge can be entertaining and knowledge should be entertaining, which has, you know, completely transformed the face of contemporary art. And I think all of us have flirted with entertaining a little too much most of the time. And so I wanted to know, you know, clearly you kind of criticize that approach to museums. But I was curious, what is a museum for an artist and what is also for museum directors? Is it a place for entertainment? Is it a site of oblivion? It's a place where you go and forget what's outside the door? Or it's a place where you go, you know, I was at a panel a couple of weeks ago and somebody said museums are great because when people are there, they're usually not shooting guns. And it's a paradox, but it's quite something. You know, it's a place where certain things don't happen and other things happen. Is that a place where you go to forget what's outside
when
the door?
When I go to museums?
Yeah.
Well, that's a totally different experience than most people have.
So I'm curious to know what's your experience.
What is it, a museum for me when I go into a museum? Firstly, it's almost impossible to, basically my position is when you look at art, you should have time to look at the art, to be able to think about the art. And so this trend to plug in a thing, you know, this is like a painting talking to you. What does that have to do? For instance, they're talking about a little tiny blue dot over in a Matisse. This is not talking, first you don't have time to really look at the painting, right? But we don't have to brag about that. But I think museums are really very burdened with having to need money, which means they need blockbusters, that they need attendance. And more compelling is that need to entertain the people. And people are really not, never mind. Okay, so.
People are not.
More or less, blah, 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 yeah.
Okay. I'll pass on the word to Julia Payton-Jones, and actually we'll engage in a discussion. And this, I think, leads, in a way, to a few questions that I have for you. The transition between entertainment and also another important issue that I thought you raised in your text is the issue of participation. And as you were talking about cybernetics and digital culture, I was thinking, isn't YouTube, and this might sound banal, but the ultimate museum of contemporary humanity where you can go, and it's actually a museum made by the people, whatever that means. And so I'm also, you have challenged at the Serpentine, especially since Hans Ulrich has also joined you, you have challenged the way in which people can participate, the whole use of the pavilion and the whole use of lectures and marathons and interviews. So I'm sure you have a few insight on participation and entertainment. So
yes, absolutely. But it's very interesting that Elaine mentioned the word quite simply more than once, money. Because in a way, you know, we're sitting in this this situation, which is a sort of section of the art fair, whereby we are surrounded by money, money coded in different ways. And the thing that I think is really something to just mark is the moment that within an incredibly short period, the focus of the commercial sector through Frieze Art Fair and what it's done for this city, it's really completed the circle of what was perhaps missing before, in that we didn't have an art fair of international standing, and that really has changed. And as the Turner Prize really moves perhaps away, it's now moved out of London to Liverpool, perhaps that in the appetite for contemporary culture, which undoubtedly exists in this country now, and thank God it does, because it helps all of us, the attendance at the Serpentine or museums, and how we engage with the work of artists across all art forms. It's a moment that really allows us in a variety of different ways to test how culture is being presented to us through art fairs, through what museums show, what artists show outside the museum. But to get back to the Serpentine, one of the things that I wanted to do when I invited Hans Ulrich to come and work at the Serpentine was to see what we could do as a museum without a collection to reinvent the model, and to reinvent the model of what it means to be an institution like the Serpentine Gallery at this point in time. And what I felt quite strongly was that it was no longer really perhaps reasonable or practical for one person to carry the burden of the money on the one hand, the practicalities on the other, the program, which of course is the overriding backbone of everything we do, as well as develop it in a way that really is of this time. So we now have an extraordinary situation whereby we really are a laboratory. I mean, people very much talk about laboratories and experimentation as part of a cultural institution, but it is really quite difficult to create that balance in a way that's very which is meaningful. But now we have this weekend coming up with the Experiment Marathon, which is a way of extending the use of the Serpentine Gallery Pavilion, our annual architecture commission, which is unique worldwide. And we also think about this project as a sort of a way of creating objects, and all of them are collected. Not one doesn't cease to exist after its sighting at the Serpentine. So you could say, in a way, that this is another way to think about how objects are disseminated in the world in a way that's surprising, because, of course, it's architecture, not works of art.
May I ask you if you think that experimentation is possible in a fair, for example, or is it freer at the Serpentine? Through my experience, I worked, the Ron Gallery presented four projects, actually, at the art fair, and it was always a challenge in terms of logistics. At the same time, it turned out to be quite an experimental place beyond even our expectations. And so, you know, at the same time, as you say, you know, experiments need money and they need funding. They need a sort of science research model. So I was curious to know if you think that the wealthier sector can experiment more.
Yes, I mean,
can the fair be more experimental than a museum, for example?
I mean, I think one of the things that is very interesting about living at this point in time is that the model, whatever model it happens to be, always has to be reinvented. And it seems that there's probably a three-year cycle. So the invention comes in year one, it's more practiced in year two, and by year three, you need to be thinking about how it's going to be reinvented. So, and that is one of the most fascinating things that we can all do, whatever sector we're in. So I would say something like Gavin Brown's stand in this fair is a reinvention and a playing with the model of what an art fair might be, and I'm sure all of you have seen it, which is a sort of it's a sort of flea market, as he describes it, of objects, all sold for tiny sums of money by artists, many of considerable distinction in some cases, and it sort of turns on its head what the idea of an art fair can be. So I think that there is absolutely no reason why not. However, the model of an art fair clearly works, because otherwise all of you wouldn't be here, we wouldn't be here. And also sales wouldn't be good, and it wouldn't continue next year. So there are pragmatics involved in all these things.
Did you ever sell things at the Serpentine? I want to bring up this example that in the United States actually created a lot of attentions and discussion, which is the upcoming Murakami retrospective at MoCA, which includes a shop in which Louis Vuitton goods can be sold and can be bought. And the fact that there was going to be a shop inside a museum with sellable goods generated a hysteria to the point that now the museum had to declare that they're not perceiving any income from the sale of those goods, which I think is a paradox, because they are selling things that are meant to be in between artwork and ready-made, but they're not going to make any profit because somehow the profit was deemed as evil, and so the profit is going to just be Louis Vuitton and the artist, which I don't know if it's even more absurd that, you know, the only one gaining in the end is the big corporation. So I wanted to ask, did you ever experience or experiments with selling exhibitions that could be taken away or that could be bought? Actually, Hans Ulrich, one of his first shows was called Take Me, I'm Yours, and it was about this idea that the whole show could be disseminated and taken away, but not for money, I think.
No, not for money, except that the Boltanski, Christian Boltanski's piece, which was this incredible sculpture made out of recycled clothes, was so incredibly successful that after 1 week, they'd all gone, and we had no money to replace them. So the only thing we could do was replace them, then charge people £1 a plastic bag. But that was pragmatics to ensure that the piece could continue. We don't sell from exhibitions. However, I think it's also worth noting that works of art are most definitely sold from exhibitions in public spaces, but they're sold behind the scenes by dealers whose job it is. We become another kind of showcase. And this is something which is not... It's rarely acknowledged and not spoken about, but I'm afraid to say it goes on for all of us at the Guggenheim, the New Museum, any institution. And it is one of the things that I cannot tell you how irksome it is to know when you see the artist dealer walking around with a collector. I mean, maybe in some cases I'm being a little oversensitive, but it does go on. And I think one of the things that is really worth noting is how incredibly difficult it is, or challenging it is, for a publicly funded institution at this point in time to remain always progressing in the most constructive and relevant way to the institution itself, but to the sector, the public sector in general terms, when really the rise of the commercial organizations is so very, very strong, and in many cases are doing the work of our own sector. That being said, it would be wrong if I gave anything other than the impression that the more buoyant the arts situation overall is, everybody benefits. So we benefit hugely from freeze. We benefit hugely from collectors collecting more, collecting in greater depth, acquiring knowledge, and it then puts more emphasis on us to create and provide the scholarship against which these, and to make our contribution ever more distinct. So this it really is a changing landscape.
Can I interrupt you? Because the FAIR model is clearly so successful that on, you know, Peter Schlegel in the New Yorker has said that the Art Fair is the biennial of the 2000. It's what the biennial was in the 90s. It's been completely taken over by the FAIR, which offers a model that it's quite similar to the shopping mall, in which you have many different stores and you have different experiences, and it's easier to go there than maybe to go to museums, or they feel more user-friendly than museums. So my question is, it's clearly a successful model, and it's clearly a symbiotic relationship with museums, but what can the Serpentine, or what can a museum offer that this place doesn't offer? And
well, I think one of the things that we are a bridge to the public. You know, museums are educational charities, and we are not for profit. Our job is not to make money, but it's to exist in a very sort of simple and straightforward way to inform and educate the public. But I think one of the things about the art fair which is worth saying is that it's like grazing. It's like, you know, it really is like the experience of being in a supermarket. It can be as in-depth as you want it, or it's a question of just letting these images flow over you as you walk down the aisles and you see works of art. Now, when you go to a museum, an art gallery, something even the size of the Serpentine Gallery, the experience is unbelievably different, because the engagement with the object is fundamentally different. And also, to a degree, different rules apply. You know, here there's an absolute, I'm always fascinated by art fairs, there's the overwhelming amount of images, and how you, as Lisa described, you know, things come to the top, things rise to the surface that remain with you. But that, so in terms of how we do it and what the experience is, I suppose it is always to try and create a situation whereby the people who come, and we have 800,000 visitors a year, that they really adopt the institution as their own, and they also can relate to the works of art we show. It's particularly evident with the pavilions, and architecture, of course, is one of the ways in which institutions reinvent themselves by making a new wing, or indeed, Massimilio, a new museum, which of course you're in the process of doing.
Is there anything from a fair that you wish you had in your institution, besides the money?
I think it is would possibly be this this constant state of living in the present, of living absolutely in the moment. And what we do is not always live in the moment, because we need to create a balanced program. But this is absolutely about this moment in time right now, not yesterday and not tomorrow. And what we really need to be doing, as Lisa was talking about, was to even though we're not a collecting institution, think about longevity and think about not just presenting what the programs of a commercial gallery, but presenting art that we think is going to be relevant, and artists also relevant, in 10 years' time, in 50 years' time, in 100 years' time. So the program seems really robust, and it would be my great pleasure as director if I could look back on the program we've done over 15, 16 years and see that each of those artists now are still making work, they're still important, and they're not people who've risen to the surface and fallen away again. Because the institution, the public institution, has to be one which is really creating in its own way through scholarship, through commissioning artists or architects, something that is going to stand the test of time. And that really is one of the many differences about the public sector and the private sector, even though now we are closer than ever, and that is an entirely good thing. But still, that difference needs to be maintained, I would say.
Could I say something?
Yes, please.
I think
the problem here is that so much of current art is temporal and dependent on context, excuse me. So that if you talk about long-term, and of course, one of the great things about directors and curators is that they have references. So this is how you're capable of making very good choices, whereas most people have no references or wrong references. But so to determine, I mean, which I guess would be, firstly, it seems a little off to say, even though you have to say it, it seems a little off to say, well, we want to buy art that in the future will be very substantial and will be seen as a good choice. If you're talking about 20 years, even 10 years, the context is long lost. So in which case, the art is very difficult to see in its dynamics, right? So then it has the possibility of becoming very dead without that. And then also the temporality is so close to what is surrounding us and what is with us now that I would guess it'd be almost impossible, which I'm sure it isn't with all your experience, to make a determination this art will be around in 20 years or important art, except for some very overwhelming artists like Damien Hirst, who will be around because he's been so big. A funny criterion,
but
isn't
what
it?
You're saying is also, I witnessed it even in the last 7 years. What the result of that understanding of art is that the only objective factor to measure art is the price, which, you know, because the context gets lost and because you never know, because everything is subjective and so on, what we have witnessed is that the only objective parameter is the price, and which is what it's leading
one of the
market,
dilemmas,
and it's scary to me, and I think to many of you, maybe not to Lisa as a representative of the auction, that of course needs to score high prices. You know, I want to ask all of you how you feel and how do you relate as prices and money as career parameters or career makers. You know, it used to be in a way, or maybe I'm just naive, but it used to be that the price would follow a certain quality or a certain price was a recognition of a career. Now we see it in the press, we see it at fairs, we see it. Price is the product placement. You know, depending on that price, you are in a certain niche, you are in a certain career. And so in a way, the price is what locates the career in a certain place. So I don't know if you have any feeling about, I don't know, for example, for you, like how have your prices changed? How have they?
Oh, we don't want to talk about that.
No, not in a practical way, but did you feel prices were commensurate to your evolution as an artist?
Well, that would not be something that I would even think about.
You don't care about it, yeah.
Well, it isn't I don't care. You know, I mean, je dois vivre. But what I would like to say is that I think if art has assumed very high prices, there has to be some qualities about it. So you can't really, you know, just bang it in half. But then, of course, you have the interference of invested interest, which these collectors and other people guard very closely. So, but there has to be something, an artist who is in very high prices has to have something going for it. But, Lisa?
Well, I don't think price is an indication of quality or value.
Good.
Honestly, and you know, a lot of art just simply has no intrinsic value. It's a piece of paper and a pencil on it. It is, you know, there's nothing there that has actual material value. So price right now seems to be driven by market forces, by a supply and demand in a way, by a belief somehow that this is a valuable commodity that is limited and finite, that only a certain amount of these are of huge quality, and that consequently, because the supply is limited and the demand is high, it presses the value up. But who's determining that demand? And that's the slippery slope here, because, you know, it's I think, a relatively few individuals with a lot of disposable income who are often driving prices. But in the end, it's what the market will bear. And I don't think we should ever assume that the record-breaking price at, let's say, auction or at an art fair has any equation that this is the best. It's simply just two different phenomenons, the market itself versus, I think, the kind of choices, as you say, that you have to make for eternity, impossible to do, about the lasting value of something, and that only reveals itself over a huge, huge amount of time. But, you know, I do like what you say, this whole dilemma of something that exists in a temporal moment that we understand today because we live in this culture and because a lot of art references our culture and society, and taking understanding, but yet art to endure, to have value, has to be lasting, and it may have a different meaning or a different interpretation in 50 years or 100 years. So therein lies the quandary, and that's where social history and all of that are important as we look at contemporary art history to really go back and try and understand context. But there is always that lost in translation problem.
Yeah.
But don't you feel like, if you look around, the supply is pretty big, you know? So that's something that to me is incredibly puzzling, that it is a supply and demand market, but I have more problem with, you know, restricting the supply than, you know, the whole issue is that the supply seems to be infinite at the moment and still fetch incredibly high prices. You know, your point of view, of course, applies to the Warhols and the Koons, but here we have a market of, you know, potentially infinite supply. And how come we're still willing to pay a lot of money for it?
Well, not for a lot of what the infinite supply is. I mean, I have talked to some dealers here who within the first 2 hours sold everything in their booths, and others who haven't, because a lot of people collect, you know, with their ears, and they want what they perceive everyone else wants. I talked to a collector yesterday who's new to the contemporary art market, and she needed a strategy. And her strategy was she saw well-known collectors from the city she lives in a booth on the floor going through works on paper by an artist. And when they left, she went to the dealer and say, I'd like a work by that artist and a painting. She could not remember the name of the artist 3 hours later. She had never heard of the artist, but she thought, okay, if these people who are respected collectors in my community are buying this artist, that's where I should start. So, you know, these factors that drive this often are for all the wrong reasons. And although there's endless supply of art, there's not endless supply of art. I mean, people aren't endlessly willing to put down their money for anything. There are all sorts of factors that I think determine where someone is willing to make that kind of commitment, that financial commitment.
I mean, one of the things that I'd like to say about your question, your last question, is that the fact that I imagine that price or value enters a discussion when a dealer is deciding what they bring to an art fair, and that will possibly define who they show and what they show. When we construct our programs at the Serpentine, either the exhibition program or the architecture program or the education public programs, the value of what we show absolutely is not, it doesn't enter the discussion. It is not mentioned, it's not relevant, and that is really a fundamental difference in the starting point between the two sectors, and perhaps worth talking about and enunciating in this context as we sit here. But also what we talked about a little bit before we began this today's event was really who now is driving the car in terms of the current contemporary art scene, because it really has changed quite significantly. It's always been artists, but really artists now are the drivers of the car resolutely in a way that perhaps in other decades may not have been so clear.
And the collector is the co-pilot.
The collector is the co-pilot.
He used to be the curator in the 90s.
Yes, but
I got in too late. So.
Yes, so the food chain, so to speak, really has changed. And of course, that's very, very interesting because it also is a way of sort of defining this current moment, which again won't last forever. But it is the moment that we live in and are experiencing now.
And, you know, actually, I would like to open the discussion to the public, which is a phantom in this conversation, because what does the public come and see at the fair? I'm even curious to know, like, are you coming to see people that buy? I don't see many buyers in this. So are you coming for the thrill of discovering something that you might be able to buy? Or, you know, it's also a very interesting mode of consumption of art. So, you know, I think all of us would welcome all your questions, but I'm sure many of us also have questions to you. Like, what do you expect from a museum? What do you expect from a fair? And what do you expect even from an artist or an auction house? I think, I must have struck a good chord because she's going to insult us now.
Hi, I'm a new gallerist, and my question is actually about the beginning of the food chain. With the Olympics coming up in London in 2012, the public funding for new artists and emerging galleries is really drying up. It's very hard to get money out of the Arts Council these days. So you're sitting here now in 2007. What do you think the effect is going to be when we get to the Olympics? Is your food chain still going to be alive and kicking?
I don't know. You know, I go often to Athens because I work with a collector there, and they have a wonderful expression, which is post-Olympic syndrome, because which means like a city that gets, you know, suddenly dozens of stadiums and new buildings and so on, and then has to cope with probably more space and more architecture than they needed. It's like a giant Christmas banquet then. But you know, there are cities like in Turin, where I'm also quite familiar with, in which the Olympics, the Winter Olympics, they brought a lot of money to art. So I'm not aware of how things are going here in London, but the Winter Olympics, they generated lots of exhibitions, some of them kind of silly. There were suddenly more shows about snow and mountains and landscapes than probably humanity should ever see. But it was, it did have a fallout on the understanding of culture as a important resource for marketing a city. Whatever that means, but I'm sure you probably know much more about this in locally than.
Well, I'm just wondering if your question is about the competition for funding, and if it is, then I think this is going to be an invention of another kind of model, and the invention of the other kind of model, a new model, will have to be to take into account that, of course, the Olympics are like a greedy baby, and, you know, all of us in the public sector may well find ourselves, you know, a little short of food. So, but the thing about these situations, I think it's really important to realize that, and I'm not sure if it's particularly true of the UK, or maybe it's something that I notice here, is that recently, you know, the beginning of this sort of seismic shift in terms of the reception of contemporary culture began, for at least to my mind, when, you know, Frieze the exhibition took place, which was really a response, artist's response, to the fact that there weren't galleries prepared to show their work, that there was no support. And, you know, this attitude, I think, and the situation of the Olympics will provoke, because it has to, I mean, it's, you know, it's an imperative, another kind of model to address what could be a situation that's quite tough. I think one has to be optimistic about finding a solution.
Or do shows about sport. I'm sure you'll get plenty of funding.
It's the moment to, you know, again, as an American, which is where we do not get money from the government to support art, this is the moment you will find in London and Great Britain that the corporations will step up. They will want visibility. They will really want to be at the center of the Olympics. So that's where you need to go to get your money right now. Lock them in, promise them places of privilege, underwriting the shows at the Serpentine where the audience is, and use it as a moment to get more private support for the arts, which has not been the tradition here.
There was a, you
There is a microphone if you...
I haven't heard anybody talk yet about the sanctifying effect on an artist of having their work in a museum. It's a sort of benediction. Could somebody talk about that?
I was cynically referring to the sanctifying effect of prices, which maybe Lisa, having stepped on the dark side or the brighter side of the force, she can tell us about. I think nowadays that sanctifying effect, unfortunately or fortunately, is being taken over by the auction.
I think so too. I think people do
and
not.
And I'm uncomfortable. I
agree with you. I don't think the museums. I don't think there is a benediction that guarantees any market share. I think to the contrary, as Elaine said when she said nobody wants a retrospective, then you're dead, is often being put in a museum environment is not the best thing for an artist. A full-scale museum exhibition might mean that you've had your moment in the sun and people forget about you, shelve you, go on to the next new thing, and in fact can have a dampening effect on your market. So I'm not sure the benediction is there at all.
Wow. But would you have answered the same way 3 months ago?
Yes.
But there's the additional problem with a very huge museum show. Very often you begin to see the pattern of an artist, and then that starts taking away the force and power of the work. So what one has to do is resist and really keep it at a very, you know, kind of level where it moves and it has power. But most artists really want to show all their work.
And you know what else? Sorry to interrupt, but if you're a living artist, which is different, obviously, and you're in a museum show, one thing that will happen is collectors will call you if you're putting together, curating an exhibition, begging you to borrow their works because they think it will give the work more value. And somehow, if the work is not chosen for the exhibition, which could be for very good reasons, collectors often lose faith in the work that they have, and they believe it wasn't a top-tier work, and they may look to sell it, or somehow feel that there was some, you know, validation that wasn't given to their work of art. And I think that is extremely problematic. Or a work that is in an exhibition may all of a sudden be seen as having more value than another work by an artist that might not be in an exhibition for all the right or wrong reasons. So it's very, very tricky what happens. And as Julia said, it is true. You know, we used to have something in the loan form at the Guggenheim that said, any art that is sold or transacted during the course of the exhibition, the museum has to get 15% of it. And all museums have that, and it's never been exercised by anyone. But you do see, you know, right now the Guggenheim has the Richard Prince show. Richard has multiple dealers on all continents, and you do see people walking through the show as if it were indeed an art fair or a sale room, saying, yeah, you want to do this, or I'll sell this, or I could get you this, or, you know, if you blah, 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 and it happens. It's just...
Yeah, but life is very dangerous, so that's okay, right. You know? I mean, that's the way it goes.
One of the other things is that a museum show used to be a way, when you talk about benediction, it was a way that an artist might get a catalog, for example. Or they might have an exhibition tour to another country. Or there were certain things that a museum show could do that were not possible in other contexts. But the interesting thing about this moment in time is that that's no longer true, because the commercial sector do the most incredible catalogue resumes with very, very distinguished scholarship. So it's not necessary for an artist to wait anymore to have a very well-considered essay written about their work, or indeed to have a press response to it, or indeed even a public response. So those, again, it's another example of how the division between the sectors has broken down, and so the sort of sanctification or the beatification even, you know, really doesn't need to exist only from the museum model.
But do you, as an artist, I asked you before this question, you are pleased when your work goes into a museum collection?
Well,
you're more
rare,
pleased so. Than if it goes into a private home, or?
Actually, that's very rare, so yeah. I don't get that pleasure very often. But of course, it's, firstly, I think when you do your work, when I do the work, it's mainly the main push and shove is that I would like people to understand what I'm trying to talk about and what I'm going for. So yes, once it gets in the museum, people say, oh, maybe I should pay attention. No, you can't deny that.
I mean, the museum, going back, and then we'll listen to more questions, is the only place in which the context that you were talking about can be preserved. You know, there is Umberto yes. Eco wrote this beautiful essay once yes. about his dream exhibition would be a show in which there is only one picture, but then there is the whole culture around through books, essays, poems that yeah. make you understand that picture. And I think it's I think the museum can do that.
Yes,
that provides
definitely.
The context.
But then that's very that,
that
can
picture.
Be very tricky, huh? Because then it could be all about what's surrounding us and not
yeah.
about the art. So it's a little difficult to do. But I don't think you can underestimate, no matter what power money has, the force of museums. I mean, they really are. They are not going to go away, and they're not going to lose their ability to give prestige and status. Don't you agree? You have to, otherwise
yeah,
you wouldn't
yeah.
be in a museum.
Yeah. Let's see if there are other questions. There is one in the front and one in the back. Whoever gets the microphone first.
Hello, I wanted to bring up the question of the responsibility that museums have to the public in a sort of educational capacity and audience development. I, for example, actually live in Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, and there isn't actually a museum. Soon there will be down the road in Abu Dhabi, which is a whole other interesting point to bring in. But in Dubai, the responsibility for this audience development and education falls actually on the local galleries. You know, you're saying that museums here are educational charities, but in Dubai, it's the local galleries, which are commercial operations intrinsically, but they actually run programs because there isn't a museum there to do it. So this was really a question as to how you feel, particularly Julia, responsibility towards developing an audience which may potentially be a potential buying audience or an engaged audience in the future.
I mean, a museum doesn't really exist without an audience. And I really like the idea that more and more people come to see what we do because that's why we exist. And so developing an audience is very much part of that, and it's done in a number of different ways. It's also, if you're publicly funded, which we are to 16% only, it's part of our contractual agreement with the Arts Council. So the diversification of audience, accessibility, all of those things are absolutely central to what we do, and we work very hard. We have policies and strategies to address that. I mean, it's interesting in Dubai, since you mentioned it, how you know, there is certainly the money to create museums, but for them, the audience, it seems early days for an audience. And so if you're starting from a clean sheet of paper, I mean, really, where do you go? And they seem to be, if I've understood it correctly, it's more of an event culture. So it's sort of, it's more to do with festivals and things like that. And your other question, I think, was to do with education. And if you're a publicly funded institution, again, in this country at least, you have to engage with education and public programs. But, you know, education programs is just another way of looking at audience. And we engage with education and public programs for people from 3 to 93 and beyond in a variety of different ways. And it is just, we always work with artists and tailor-make projects, especially for groups. But it's a part of the dynamic and it's part of the tapestry of enriching all the groups that come to see our work, which of course is getting back to contemporary culture, contemporary art, architecture, design, which is really what we're talking about at the base of everything today, whether we're referencing an art fair or whether we're referencing a museum. At the core of this, the subject is art, and thank God for it.
I don't know if, Lisa, you want to add anything. I'm curious about, in your transition, are you going to miss the audience? And who is the audience of auctions?
It's all one audience, actually. You know, I'm engaged with the same people. What I loved, as I said, about museums was building collections. And now I'm working with people who are building their collections. And it's amazingly the same group of people that I was involved with at the museum, only a little bit broader because we had a specific focus in modern and contemporary art. And now I can look at all collecting categories and look at all of these new interesting emerging markets. So I feel it's broad. And the other thing about auction houses is they do support institutions. We actually do give money away, and I'm thrilled to be sort of on that side of the fence, so that I will have a broader relationship with more institutions in our capacity as a grant-giving organization. So I feel I will be involved with the same audience. And I think the great thing about auction houses is they're open to the public. You can walk in, you can see exhibitions. Our catalogs have incredibly good art historical writing. You can learn from them. So as Julia said, the boundaries between the sort of mission of the gallery, the auction house, the museum are very much blurred today. And you can indeed find scholarship at your galleries and scholarship at your auction houses and more, and you can buy things out of museums, as we've been talking about.
There was a question back there, I think.
Hi, I have a gallery in Sydney that deals in emerging artists, and I just wanted to go back to a point that Lisa made earlier, where you don't necessarily feel the need for speed when it comes to buying works, because you'll get a lot of, you know, the collections from the collectors later on. Can you just develop that comment a bit more? Because we're constantly, you know, fanning our feathers in front of the institutions, and, you know, they come in and they look, but there's a real, you know, waiting game that we have to play. And is that because they're waiting? I mean, are the collectors really the new curators, or?
Well, I think collectors always had the advantage of being able to make choices on their own, purely on the basis of whether they wanted something or not. Whereas museums have to make choices with very limited acquisition funds. They know that once a work comes into the collection by a contemporary artist, certainly in the United States, you cannot deaccession the work of a living artist, so you've made a long-term commitment to keep it. There are huge choices all over the place. So, and some of our greatest contemporary institutions in the world, the New Museum and the Serpentine, are not actually collecting institutions, although I don't know, maybe Massimiliano will tell us if they're drifting in that direction. So the question then is I think galleries have a better chance of having the work bought by collectors and ultimately potentially given to museums than hoping the museum curator will come in and say, aha, I've discovered this artist, I'm ready to make that kind of commitment. I think certainly in our museum it's not unheard of, but it's rare. That said, I think you have to get your work in front of everyone. I think there are all sorts of forums. When I was a young curator, I did a lot of emerging artist shows, and you do what you can. But the speed comes from the fact that there are layers at a museum of approval processes where you have to, as a curator, be convinced of something, convince your director of that, then convince your board of trustees of that, and make sure you have the funding in place. And that is a time-consuming and, you know, a kind of path that there's no guarantees. So if I see something at an art fair as a museum curator and I ask them to put it on reserve for me, they know that it may be a six-month proposition to get through the filters versus the collector who walks in and who will wire transfer the money next week.
Which is, you know, we haven't raised this point, and maybe it's a whole different topic, but one interesting phenomenon of these last years is the expansion of private museums. Some of the most active foundations and institutions are actually emanation of private individuals. And, you know, what you were saying about galleries in Dubai, I'm from Milan, and in Milan, for many, many years, galleries were the only place where you could see contemporary art. And they were, I mean, also in Paris, like before, you know, before the 70s in Paris, for the longest time, it was contemporary galleries that they were leading. And then something happened with the fashion industry that introduced the idea of the foundation, and that generated a whole new perception of what a private collector can do and how a private collector can make a public, can create a public institution. Then you don't, you know, again, you walk around London and at every corner there is the Wallace collection, there is the Sir John Soane collection. So it's a model that existed forever, probably, that, you know, the private collectors buys. And some of these private collections, unlike museums, are extraordinary because of the focus of their vision. I don't know how many of you saw the Art Tempo exhibition in Venice during the Venice Biennale. That was a huge success, and I think it was a huge success because it was you were there and you were seeing mostly the work chosen by one collector. It was a little tricky because they didn't really say it was the case, but you know, sometimes collectors have this unique opportunity of showing the work and showing also their own vision, which I think it's quite remarkable. But I don't know if...
Can I just say something about that, which is it is an incredibly positive thing that collectors are buying in depth and deciding to open their own spaces. And as you've given so many distinguished examples, and of course Dominique Demille, who really is perhaps the most extraordinary of all. However, one of the things that's so interesting, I think, in France, for example, the purchasing power of the Pompidou has dropped by 2/3. There is a general demise in the funding of museums that has hit the UK for some time in advance, but it's a sort of general state of play, I think. And so the challenge, I think, for the public institutions is to make sure that they don't lose works that they need to enhance their collection. The great example is the Museum of Modern Art in New York, when it reopened after its the period it was shut for renovation, was to see yet again how extraordinary that collection is and to compare it to our own here in London at Tate Britain and Tate Modern. Not that they're not distinguished collections, but there is a significant gap. And it's really this is about our collective histories and going into the future. And it's really how to ensure that our public institutions actually attract those donations, those gifts, either through purchasing themselves or through donations, so that our public institutions really continue to thrive. But it's a really significant challenge, I think, for institutions worldwide, when there are now so many alternatives to the true and tried and tested route.
So if you bought anything, you can leave it by the door.
Exactly.
Also, then you have these collectors who normally would give the works to museums are doing their ego trip by having their museums. And then also many collectors are now, I think, are putting their works up into auction instead of considering it as a gift to a museum. That's a very disastrous kind of shift, right? So, and it's certainly taking a lot of the dynamics out of museums. So I think that's, and then also some of these collections are not so good, you know. So.
We should take a couple of more questions and then probably, there are like 1, 2, 3.
What Elaine just said relates very much to the question I'd like to put to Lisa Dennison. Is that in a sense, it's obvious to us all that the power in the art world is being run by the auction houses. And where I feel in the old days, maybe I'm wrong and correct me, that there was a kind of unwritten law about a lack of a distance and a polite distance between the galleries and the auction houses. Now that's definitely being broken, and there's a lot of collusion between the galleries and the auction houses. And I'd like to ask you two questions. One is that, is your shift from the role in museum, from public into commercial, is it to do with actually a will to introduce a more ethical role in, in the department of the auction spin?
Well, boy, loaded question. You will never hear me saying that there is collusion between the auction houses and the galleries, no. And nor do I think we breach ethics. And I can only speak for Sotheby's, which is a public company and very transparent in its interactions. If a work is guaranteed, we will tell you that. We will give you an estimate, we will tell you the provenance, we will guarantee authenticity, you will have a condition report, you will see our P&Ls and our balance sheet, so we're a full-fledged corporation. I think the power does very much lie in the auction house today, and I cannot deny that I was intrigued by that, and after a 30-year career in a museum, felt that this was where the excitement was. It was a very relevant time for auction houses, and I wanted to be part of that and just have change in my life. But I will bring the same standards I brought as a museum director to the auction house. Honestly, my role is to deal with clients at a very high level, and the opinions that I give them will honestly, because this is the kind of person I am, will be based on the same criteria I would use as a museum director advising collectors, which I did because the hope there was that they would give us the collection in down the road, that if I helped people build good collections from the market, that those collections would come to the museum and I would have a leg up in bringing them there because I'd have a relationship. So now I'll have a relationship with collectors, but I do believe that I can honestly stand in front of a work of art and assess its value and help a collector decide whether this belongs to their collection or not and what are the strengths and weaknesses. And in one case, it may be that it's just undervalued, that, you know, there's a huge buy here. In another case, it may be the Rakib Shah, the cover lot of the Sotheby's catalog, the greatest work he's ever made, and that's an extraordinary opportunity. May not be the best value, but a great opportunity in terms of the quality of the work of art. So hopefully, I will maintain my very, very high standards and value system at the auction house, to answer your question.
That's can I just say something?
Sure.
That's a little scary. We have one person who's making all these determinations. You understand what I'm saying?
No, we don't have one person. We've got lots of people.
Yeah, no, I know that. But, okay.
Let's what I want back. To say that art is never a matter of ethics, but of aesthetics. So
is it on?
Yeah.
2 weeks ago in Berlin, there was a really heated debate between two very prominent gallerists and two very prominent representatives of the auction houses. And of course, the key piece that kept going back and forth was the closing in on the primary market, in a sense, or getting close to resales. And as an artist and a professor, one of the things I really noticed was that they kept saying there's a blur and distinctions maybe aren't that important, but there's a really huge distinction. The artist gets about 50% if it goes through a dealer, and the dealer works in a long-term relationship, hopefully, with, you know, creating the best working conditions for the production and the creativity of that person. And in the auction houses, sometimes within just a couple of years, this work is often sold again for a lot of extra money, for which the artist almost never receives anything, except perhaps in Europe this 1%. Do you think the auction houses, and I know it might be putting Lisa on the spot a bit, will, because of this new turn in the market, actually sit down and look at the possibility of a return to living contemporary artists when the work is sold so closely, given that in music and in writing, the royalties of the copyright stay with the artist for their lifetime. And in visual art, we're a completely unregulated industry, which has caused a great deal of these new kinds of profits that rarely go back to the producer, who is the artist, for which there is no otherwise a gallery or an auction house.
Well, it is a big problem and a dilemma and a very worthy subject of debate. Let me just say that in a gallery, first of all, the dealer doesn't often give the artist 50%. It depends on your relationship with your dealer. Sometimes the dealer takes a very small percent. Sometimes the dealer takes a very big percent. But wherever the resale happens in the secondary market, whether it's at the auction house or a gallery, let's say you have sold Mr. X's painting to Mr. Y, secondary market, you've made a huge profit. You don't necessarily go find the artist and say, oh, by the way, I just resold your painting and you should share in the profits. So it happens at the galleries, it happens at the auction market. I do think that there should be a way for artists to participate in the resale on the secondary market wherever it happens of their work. I don't know how that can happen, but it's something I passionately, of course, believe in. The one thing that an auction market does do for the artist when records are made is it raises their market. So going back to the primary market, let's say a work has just transacted for a record-breaking price, the likelihood is that if the artist is living, the dealer will say, aha, well, my Richard Princes are not worth $100,000 today, they're actually worth $200,000, and at the primary market level, it will help raise an artist's prices. But a dealer has to be careful to do that, to just not say that one auction record has all of a sudden changed the world, but to understand, again, the supply-demand phenomenon, and that will help an artist in a primary market. But it's a very worthwhile debate and, you know, a big issue, certainly in America.
I totally disagree. But there are many reasons. This is becoming like if you're an artist and you say, firstly, I think if you think your work is going to be very valuable, don't bother to sell it. And if you don't sell it, it's not going to become valuable. I think you have to, it's too cut and dry, you know. This is what, it's supposed to be creative, it's supposed to be dynamic, it's supposed to be exciting. It's not supposed to be about 20 years from now, somebody, I'm losing 100,000 euros. This is not the way it works. It's too rigid. I think you have to say, this is wonderful that this work is now selling for this money, if you equate the amount of money it sells for to how prestigious or what the status of that work is.
You know, there is something that, because we are in the fair, but we always tend to talk about money, but there is something which is the reason partially I'm involved in this field, that art is also about gratuity. And we don't remember that, and we don't unfortunately talk about that. But you know, I do not have any work by Sturtevant, but I do all her work. You know, her work is mine just because I can see, I can think about it, I can put it in my head. And I think that's, you know, once in a while we should remind ourselves that the beauty of art is that I have her work without having her around in my living room, thank God. Without having anything by her in my living room, I think it's...
That's very nice.
Very, very important aspect of art, which, unlike many other goods, you can possess without actually materially having it there. And, you know, I think maybe as a curator or as a person that works in a museum, I should always remind myself and the public that, you know, you all own what's out there. I know it might sound like a stupid way to cope with it, but we do own her work and many other works because they've been in our heads, and they probably, you know, it's probably the most precious place where to have it. So perfect. I don't know if there are other questions or...
That's such a good one.
Maybe last question. I guess we're all getting a little tired. Oh, he had asked, so two last questions, because he had raised his hand before, one back there and one here. I don't know if I missed you.
Hi, thank you all for coming. I don't remember who, but somebody, all of you have addressed issues of identity, whether it be from an institution or a gallery standpoint. And then again, I don't remember who mentioned it, but it was museums as collectors of collections. And I can think of a few major museum shows recently that have been of private collections, and they've been curated by the collectors. And I'm curious about this issue of identity as a museum, as a regional institution, if that's a moot point, or is that dictated by who they can get to donate their collection? Do you know what I mean? And at that point, is it a matter of, again, regional taste, or you know that weird gray area of collector interest?
Well, I think one thing that's happening in the United States is museums are no longer willing to show private collections. There's been a real crackdown on that. And the only circumstances under which someone will do that is if the collection is a gift, or at least if there's a significant component of works coming from the collector, or it could be a corporation, back to the collection, because otherwise all it does is add value to that collection, and there's a real trend away from that. In terms of, I'm not quite sure I understand your question in terms of regional museums, and are you asking if they have a responsibility to the local community to try to show that work and ultimately bring it under their umbrella?
Sure. You talked about a different model of a museum. Mm-hmm. A possibility of that being an identity of the museum as sort of a saving grace. Why go to this museum? Why go to the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston if you can go to the Tate and see essentially the same work?
Right.
So if you would address the idea of the solution being an identity of a museum. But if the museum's identity is based on its collection, do you know what I mean?
A museum's identity is based on a lot of things. Its collection is certainly one. Its program, exhibition program, is another. Its architecture can be another. The way it sits within the local community can be another. So I think identity is a compilation. But I do think it's essential that museums have identities that distinguish them, because that's the whole point of decentralization. Otherwise, one could argue for one huge national gallery, let's collect all of the nation's treasures, put them in Washington, D.C. If you want to see art, that's where you go. So I'm a big believer, you know, in the decentralization model with a carefully thought out mission more than identity of the institution that can be fulfilled within that local community.
Shall we get the last question, unless you want to add something? It was back there. At the very, very end. It's actually somebody we pay, no?
Hi, I was interested to get your views on something that came up quite a bit earlier about works in public institutions that where transaction sales arise through an exhibition, though it might not have been the intended outcome, and the public institution not receiving any commission, whereas obviously the dealer and the artist involved will. And I've been running a small public gallery, the Pump House, not far from Julia in Battersea Park, for 10 years. And we've increasingly been trying to encourage dealerships where we're liaising to borrow work for exhibitions to share a small amount of the commission with us. We're not regularly funded by the Arts Council, and we really need to find money wherever we can. And it really seems sort of reasonable to us that a small amount of that transaction should come our way, but we've hit huge obstacles, and I was interested to have your views on that.
Well, I think it is very difficult getting those percentages or whatever agreement you may have from dealers from them, whether it is, as Lisa has described, on the loan form of the Guggenheim, or whether it's indeed we've had similar contractual agreements. It's very, very, very difficult to do. So the challenges you're facing are no surprise, except to say, you know, keep going.
And don't ever agree to send, to disperse an object to someone other than to whom you borrowed it, because you are then participating in just helping transfer something that might have been sold to its new owner. So
I guess that's it. Thank you so much. And remember that a museum